Session number 13441, wheel number 2.
Vice Marshal Blair Oliphant, Trail 2. What were the main problems you had in doing your job at RAF HQ Middle East?
What was the main
problems that you had in doing that job?
Oh. I think largely getting spares from England, you know. Getting things up to sort of top line war level, making sure that everything was right. There weren't great problems. What did we have? We had gladiators, fighters, weren't they, and Blenheims.
Did you feel that you were just getting the cast-offs from the UK armament?
Getting the...
Just the cast-offs, the second best?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's all standard stuff, and we... We started, you see, using live bombs. We used to go out. That was a great thing. Nobody had ever dropped a live bomb. So they put up what Collishaw used to call postulated targets in the desert and go and bomb them. And then you began to discover that not all bombs went and exploded, you know. And then you had to find out why, what fuses had gone wrong or whatever. The first time anybody had really seen live bombs being dropped. This was in the months before we started to fight the Italians.
What were the type of reasons why they didn't explode?
I don't know. Technically, what they were. The fuses, I suppose, were bad, or there were mistakes that had been made in the manufacture.
What was life like in Cairo in 39-41?
Interesting question. I got there in July 39. We were the Air Force headquarters, and it was in a building called Villa Victoria. We only worked in the morning, and I think on Saturdays, which was race day at Gazeera, we went to work in plain clothes, not uniform. And we got 30 days local leave a year. And I think if that was threatened, I think any doctor would tell you that it's endangered your health. So that was the... And then gradually, you see, as things started, we began to be re-equipped and more stuff came out, and obviously and people started going back to work in the afternoons. Rather surreptitiously. And it wasn't very long before we were working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, or whatever it was, you know. Nobody's health seemed to suffer. And when Tedder arrived as Commander-in-Chief, the first thing he said is, everybody is to have a day off a week, which was very good, sensible. But it was interesting, you know, from this really only working in mornings before, because of the heat and all the rest of things, you then discovered that you could work so home hours without really any difficulty.
Where did the staff from the HQ go to for their recreation?
Well, you could go to Palestine, or you could go to Cyprus, or also, I mean, those days were interesting places to go to.
What about places in Cairo area?
Yes, well, Cairo was... the British were, you know, very much in the... Who was our ambassador at the time? Miles Lampson. And very much told Farouk what to do, you know. I mean, the British were, it wasn't a colony or even a protectorate, but the British laid down the law very much.
But people talk about going to places like Shepherd's Hotel.
Oh, yes, they went to Shepherd's. And Gazeera was a wonderful place, the club. There was a golf course and tennis courts and squash courts and a nice restaurant. I was a bachelor then, shared a flat with a chap from the embassy just opposite the gates. It was a very pleasant agreeable life. We used to sail on the Nile in the afternoon and go dancing in the evening.
Was there much contact with the Egyptian population? Did you socialise with
them? I knew a few of them, yes. Yes, there were quite a lot of friendships between British and Egyptian.
What kind of people did you get to know?
What kind of people? Yeah, I suppose they were, yes, businessmen. Businessmen and women and families. There's quite a civilized, when I say civilized, what's the word I want? Intellectual, well-educated people.
Because there were, one of the literary products of that period was Lawrence Durrell's series of books about Alexandria.
That's right.
And he seemed to have mixed with people of that time.
Yes.
Did the entry of the Germans into the Middle East War in early 1941 make much of an impact on your own work?
Wait a minute, the entry of the German...
When the Luftwaffe came in...
Oh, yes, I mean, everything hotted up. Yes. It was a very different thing between fighting the Italians. I have a friend, he's still alive, Air Marshal Dunn. Paddy Dunn, and he was commanding, I forget which fighter squadron there, and one of the things that the Italians used to do was that they would, when we sent up our reconnaissance aircraft and you run them up on the ground, up went a great plume of sand. And the Italians would spot this and say, these chaps are taking off, and get ready for them. And so the answer to this was that you put a, some time before, you put a standing patrol up at 30,000 feet, first of all, then you ran up your friend. When the Italians started to take off, you were there waiting for them. And Paddy Dunn was commanding, I think, one of these squadrons, and sure enough, he did this, and he dived down on the leading Italian pilot, who immediately climbed up into a steep climb in a loop and rolled off the top, and Paddy followed him, and he followed him everything he did, waiting merely to get into the position behind him where he could shoot him down. And the Italians are very good pilots, a lot of them, and this went on for some time, and eventually the Italian bailed out, so that his first victory in the war was that he got through, he hadn't fired a shot.
How did you come to leave this job again?
How did I come to...
Can you tell me again how you came to leave the job at HQ Cairo?
Oh, well, I was posted. I was posted to the Rhodesian Air Training Group, which was doing ab initio training of pilots and bombing and gunnery. We had a bombing and gunnery school there at Gwello. No, Gwello, Moffat. I've forgotten which. Anyway, one of the stations, and our training group. It was the Rhodesians had done very well. They provided the airfields, they did the buildings, they did a lot of the administration side, and the Air Force, of course, produced all the technical side and the flying instructors. And it was a very happy setup. It went very well. I think we had about 4 initial and 4 more advanced flying training schools and a bombing and gunnery school. And we've got a very good place to do flying training because the weather's so good. You make a program and you fly it. That's a good setup.
Did you have anything to do with the Empire training scheme there?
Well, this was part of it. I didn't see any other parts of it, but I know the Rhodesian bit was very happy. It was commanded by a South African chap called Meredith, but the senior air staff officer was RAF, and all the other staff was RAF, I think.
How did you think that scheme worked? the Rhodesian end of it, the Empire Training Scheme?
It's very successful, very happy. Unlike the South African one, which I believe was more difficult. I only say that from hearsay, but that's what I heard about it.
What was the problem in South Africa?
I don't know.
From what you heard?
I don't know. I think, yes, the South Africans probably had an air force. So did the Rhodesians. They had an air force of their own. They may have felt that they wanted to have a bigger say in it, you know. I don't know. I don't know what the reasons are. But we turned out pilots, and they then went to operational training units in Kenya. And then, I suppose, largely got drafted into squadrons in Egypt.
And then, in 43, you returned to Britain?
Yes, I got married in Salisbury, as it was then called, now Harare, and came home. And was posted to RAF Bracknell, which was then, at that time, I didn't know what it was. I went there, we'd been posted there. It was headquarters Army Corporation Command. And fairly quickly, that was disbanded, and Air Marshal Barrett, who was commanding it, was a very old timer, was moved along, and it became headquarters 2nd Tactical Air Force. And Mary, as he was known, Cunningham, was the CNC. And that was the beginning of that was the air force that supported the invasion. So we were at Bracknell. And later on, part of it, the advance headquarters was at Uxbridge. And then we moved over after the invasion. The invasion was June, wasn't it, 19... which year, 41? 44. And the headquarters moved over into Normandy at a respectful time after the invasion. June, I suppose, about August, probably.
What were your own responsibilities?
Same, I was command armament officer. And, of course, things had hotted up quite a lot. We were beginning to get rockets on aircraft, which we'd never had before, on fighter aircraft. And we had a lot of American aircraft. By that time, we had Mitchells and Bostons, bomb light and medium bombers. So
there's always, in the books that have been written, quite a lot said about why we were so late in changing from 303 machine guns to cannon.
Yeah.
Do you have any...
Yes, we had an interim. We had a .5 machine gun in between, which was an American-made thing. It was the same as the Browning gun, only scaled up a bit. And, of course, I mean, that was the great foresight on the part of I forget who it was now at the Air Ministry, which was, instead of having one or possibly two guns, to have 6 or 8 in a fighter, in the Spitfires and Hurricanes, and then cannon, 20-millimeter cannon, as you say, which gave us more. I don't know what the delay was. We had never designed guns, you see. The only gun we ever designed was a Lewis gun, which I think was a Belgian design anyway, but we made it. But the Browning guns, which we had, were American design, and the cannons were Hispano, which were Swiss. Britain hadn't gone in for gun design very much. We always bought them from somewhere else. I don't know whether there was a delay. I suppose it was just a natural thing. We had to have more. As far as I remember, .5s were only in aircraft turrets, I think, only in bomber turrets. I don't think they were ever installed in fighters.
What were the main problems that you had here in doing your work with the 2nd Tactical Air Force?
We had to think about going mobile, because we were all living on permanent stations in Britain, and we had to realise the fact that when we got in, well, after the invasion, we were living in tented camps. We were operating off strips. There were no buildings, do you know? I mean, you might have to operate So one of the things we did was to we produced a mobile armory, and all we started off with a 3-ton truck, I think, and then you equipped it and turned it into a mobile armory, which made made the work easier. Bombing up was always a great, and of course turnaround time. How quickly could you turn a fighter around, which had come back having fired all its air? How quickly could you get it down, refuel it, rearm it? There was a great deal of work was done on that.
How was that improved?
Well, merely by drills, really, working out sort of just ordinary practical things that you do to do things more quickly, do you know, more efficiently.
Who were the main characters in the HQ of 2nd Tactical Air Force?
Well, the commander-in-chief was Cunningham, who was had such success in working out army cooperation in North Africa. And so he was appointed to command the 2nd Tactical Air Force. The groups, we had 83 Group, which was commanded by Harry Broadhurst, who's still alive, famous man. 84 Group, commanded by Huddleston, who was younger, Australian. And 2 Group, commanded by that great character, Basil Embry. 2 Group with the light bomber group. He was a dynamic man. He had some Spanish blood in him, I think, somewhere. He had been captured by the Germans earlier on, before Dunkirk, and had fought his way out of captivity, killing Germans on the way with it as he came. He was a great chap. Commanded 2 Group.
Have you any anecdotes about your time with that headquarters?
Yeah, well, there are lots, really.
Were there any bad times?
No, there were amusing things. There was, not sure how much of that got written. I find it awfully difficult to recall names instantly. And there was a fellow called Lindemann, who was a professor, and he very much had the ear of the Prime Minister. And he had some sort of private factory somewhere or other. He used to invent things, and he designed, one of his earlier designs was a thing which they called the sticky bomb, which was used in North Africa, and it was a thing with plastic explosive. And the idea was that you fired it against a tank, and it then sort of blasted its way through. Wasn't a great success, I think. And Cunningham, who was always very direct, he used to refer to this thing as the Prime Minister's puffball, knowing that it had rarely been done with the aid of the Prime Minister. And when we were preparing for the invasion of Europe, there was a great deal of discussion about what weapons we would use to neutralize the beaches, bombing. And this chap Lindemann, I may say, became Lord Charwell later on. And he had a representative whom we used to send round. It was a brigadier called Jeffries. And Jeffries came to see me one day and said he had just the thing, this bomb for bombing the beaches. And I recognized it when he described it as something they had produced earlier as an anti-submarine bomb, which had not been a great success. And they were now serving it up as a suggestion for bombing the beaches. So I told Cunningham that this chap would go. He said, bring him to see me, bring him to see me. Cunningham was a very clever chap, really. He received him with the greatest charm. How kind of you to come. Now, do sit down. Now, where are your ideas? Let me look, you see. And so he started to read this chap's paper, muttering as he went in, so many inconsistencies, so many wrong conclusions. You know. Oh, dear. Oh, another, this looks like another Prime Minister's puffball. So eventually, having read all this thing, he turned to him and said, well, Jeffries, you said, glad you've come to share your ideas. I suppose you realize that if we did this, it would probably cost us 6 squadrons of Mitchells. But thank you for coming to share. And then, delightfully, when the chap got to the door, he said, "Oh, and Jeffreys," he said, "don't you go telling the Prime Minister I've been saying rude things about him." He was of a great handle of men. Very good. I always remember his office was, he didn't sit at a table. He had no files. He had no in-tray and out-tray. You went to see him in his office and he talked to you, do you know. There might be one file that he was dealing with, but there was very much the way he operated. The senior Astaf officer was a chap called Victor Groom. He's dead now, I think. And the our officer in charge of administration did a wonderful job there, Tommy Elmhurst. He's also dead now. But he did a marvellous job in all the admin support of the invasion and the very key part.
What was it like when you actually got to Normandy?
Extraordinary, really, because we'd finally, the advance headquarters in which I was a part, had gone to Uxbridge. And there were flying bombs going on. And Uxbridge was near enough to... We got all the London alerts. So it was always, you know, there was always some sort of alert going on. Also, Uxbridge was in the flying circuit of Northolt. So at night, when you heard something coming over, you weren't sure whether it was somebody landing at Northolt or whether it was a flying bomb. You know, it was... And so... And then, of course, there were V2s. They started, you know, the rocket things, which arrived without any warning. So from that situation, we then crossed over in, must have been August, I suppose, to an orchard in Normandy, in a tented camp, and the skies were blue, and we never saw an aeroplane of either nationality, because we had air superiority. The Germans went, never came up at all. And it was extraordinary to go from Uxbridge, where you were... There were continual alerts being sounded, you know, to go over after the invasion, live in an orchard where and not see an aeroplane at all. And I've forgotten the name of the village where we were now. I tried to find it on the map when I was in France the other day. Not far from Saint-Lô, Caen, that sort of area. And Cunningham was a He liked good living. He rather lived in his sort of set-up. He lived a little bit apart. He had a tent, rather like a field of cloth of gold. You know, so very well, so I'm going to have dinner with him one night. And it's interesting, because we arrived in France then, which had been, what had we been? They'd been at war for 4 years, or they'd been occupied for 4 years, and you could still go into shops in Saint-Lô and buy scent, you know, and things that we hadn't seen in England for years. And then we moved from there into a girls' school in Amiens, where we were briefly housed. It's always a delightful, I think, it's always people used to say, ring the bell if you want a mistress. Which, and from there we moved to Brussels, which had just been liberated. And my brother, who was commanding a tank squadron, was at the liberation of Brussels, moved in. And rather delightfully, some girl welcomed him with a bottle of champagne. He said, "Well, you wait." He said, "My Air Force brother will be along in a fortnight." And sure enough, she was there with another bottle of champagne. And we lived in Brussels for 6 months. We moved into the German Air Force headquarters. I forget which number, Luftgau, which is an Air Force headquarters. And they occupied a lovely building called the Residence Palace, which is a department building, right? Middle of Brussels. And we moved into it just after they moved out. And they'd left it a bit untidy, a bit of paper about, but great satisfaction to move in. They'd been there for 4 years, German headquarters. So we moved in. And we lived there for 6 months. It was quite an experience, you see, when the Belgians, who are in many ways are very like us, they're very easy people to get on. And, of course, they were overjoyed. And their hospitality was wonderful. They invite you out to dinner, and you realize what they were spending in the black market to give you, you know. And there was no smoke. There was no fuel in Brussels. There was no smoke anywhere. There wasn't any fuel. And the people were tremendously welcoming and kind. I remember we got a bit short of rations one time, and we ate terrible stuff that the Germans had left behind. It was some awful form of dried potato. It was quite horrible. But we were obviously, the rations hadn't quite caught up with us, and so we ate what the Germans had left. And then, of course, we had 83 group at that time, that was Harry Broadhurst's group, was in Eindhoven. And they occupied Fritz Phillips's home, the head of the electrical department, electrical setup. I remember going to see them there. Beautiful house, had a few bullet holes in the walls where somebody had shot through. I forget where the other headquarters were. We had, yes, one in Holland there. And this was all, you know, before the, all moving up before we went into Germany. And then I remember that famous occasion when, which year was it? 1st of January 1945, when the Germans made a last attack with their air force. And I remember going to my office, which I suppose was about on the third floor of this residence palace, that morning, looking out of the window, a German aircraft flew past. Great black cross on it. And it was a very last, you know, they piled everything they got into it, even sort of untrained pilots who were just flying in formation. And we, because we had air superiority, had got our airfields fairly far forward, so that they were really inviting attack. And we lost a lot of aircraft on the ground, which... But the Germans lost a great many in there, and of course they lost all their crews too. The ones who were shot down were all prisoners. That was, and I remember going down to Ghent that day, where it was the 84 group were at Ghent, and having seen this thing in the morning and one or two aircraft flying around being shot down, I went down, drove down to Ghent, where the Poles had a squadron or a wing there. And they'd gone out on an operation and returned to find the Germans attacking their airfield. And they really got amongst them and shot about half of them down.
That was New Year's Day.
That was New Year's Day, 45, yes. And it must have been, yes, quite soon after that, that we then moved our headquarters again to Suchtelm, which was in the Ruhr. And to everybody's great delight, we were housed in a lunatic asylum. Everybody said, that's good. Last, the headquarters has come to find it. And then I had, this is not, you know, this is personal experience rather than history, I'm telling you now. I was, at that time, I was group captain, and I was secretary of the senior officers' mess, group captains and above. And the time came for us to leave the lunatic asylum and move forward into Germany, or not Germany, into Bad Alsen, which is where we had our headquarters. It's near Hanover. And they had earmarked a large, it is a spa, Bad Alsen, a large headquarters to be, a large hotel to be the Air Force headquarters. But they said, now you, to me, you go and find a suitable place for the senior officer's mess. So I went forward and I found a hotel of the right size and shape, and I said, well, we're going to have this. And it was operating as a hotel. It was operating as a rest place for some shipping company in Bremen who sent their people down there. And so it was being run. And I think the chap in charge was a brown shirt, or anyway, he was got rid of politically. And it was interesting, you know. One arrived, and there was the lady running a hotel, and I said, well, we're taking this over. It's going to be a senior officer's mess. You've got the impression of rather pleased it's going to be a senior officer's, you know. And they said, well, yeah, which room will the general have, you see? And so I said, well, he's not a general.